Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we want to return to a story that's become both a political and a humanitarian crisis. We're talking about the surge of border crossings into the U.S., particularly of unaccompanied children. Yesterday, President Obama met with Texas Governor Rick Perry and faith leaders in the state to talk about the issue. Some are wondering why President Obama didn't take the opportunity to see the situation for himself, though, by visiting one of the detention centers or the border itself. We wanted to hear more about how this issue is playing out right now, both in the United States and in Central America, where many of the immigrants are coming from. So we've called Fernando Espuelas. He's host of the Fernando Espuelas Show on the Univision America Network. He's interviewed many of the key players in the story on the U.S. side. Also with us is Alfredo Corchado. He's a reporter with the Dallas Morning News, and he's in Honduras investigating why so many people are leaving for the border right now. And he's with us from there. Thank you both so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
Pleasure, Michelle.
Fernando, let me start with you. Texas Governor Rick Perry met with President Obama yesterday, as we said. There was some to-ing and fro-ing about whether he'd meet him at the airport or how the meeting would take place, but they worked it out. He's been blasting the president for not visiting the border, and here's Governor Perry on CNN this morning talking about this.
The real humanitarian thing, from my perspective, is to first not give them reasons to be coming here to begin with. And the other one is to reunite these families together, not, you know, continue policies that rip these families apart and send children by themselves or mothers and a baby away from their family. That's not humanitarian.
Now, some, including Governor Perry, are comparing this to George W. Bush during Hurricane Katrina when he didn't go to New Orleans. So the first thing I wanted to start with is, Do you think the president should have gone to the border, and why do you think he didn't?
Well, I think we're in an election cycle where any picture that is made of the president maybe dealing with some of these children, what's he going to do? Put on an ugly face and say, you shouldn't be here? No, he'll be smiling and welcoming because he's a human being and they're children. And that will be used politically. And I don't think it really resolves anything. Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, has been there, according to the president, 7 or 8 times already. I'm not sure if the president has to be there.
Well, what about that, Alfredo Corchado? I mean, Governor Perry and a number of other political leaders, particularly on the Republican side, are saying that it's the president's lax immigration policies that are responsible for this movement of kids across the border. You're there. What are you hearing?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, I spent the week trying to get to the bottom of the rumor, if you will, the root causes of why the migration now. And it is sort of a feeding frenzy. I mean, it's been on the front page news every day for the last few weeks, but there is a sense that this is their window, that they have to somehow get to the border now before, quote, the border shuts down again. So, I mean, we're talking to kids with mothers. I was at a bus station, several mothers with their kids, and they keep saying, look, we've heard from our trusted smuggler, the Coyote, who has said, you know, this is the time. What's interesting, Michelle, is that we are seeing people, there are stepped up efforts to bring people back, minors back. I was at a temporary shelter where you're seeing the numbers increasing. I mean, I think when I was there, there were 8 buses packed with people who had just arrived from Mexico. What was fascinating was, you know, I kept talking to mothers and saying, is this the last time you try? One after the other, you know, their response was, I just need a shower, I need to eat, I need to rest for a few hours, and then I'm going back again. And that tells you two things. One is they're going to try again, but this time around it's going to be a lot more riskier because there are countries like Guatemala, Mexico, and Honduras, no doubt under pressure from the United States, that are trying to do more to stop the miners from going back. So it's going to be, I think... I don't think this is going to stop anytime soon, but I think it's going to be a lot harder for people to get across.
But why now? Why do people feel that there is this window that is closing? Is it somehow related to the elections? I mean, why are the Coyotes telling them that this is the time to come across?
Well, there are several reasons. I think the migration, the illegal migration from Honduras has been going on for a while. It has stepped up significantly, I think, in the last couple of months. And one role that's kind of interesting is the role of social media. It's all over social media. I mean, you know, and it's not just the rich or the middle class in Honduras or Central American country who have access to smartphones. It's very poor. I mean, these people I'm interviewing at bus stations, they have nothing else, but they are checking their iPhones. I mean, not their iPhones, but their smartphones. And they're trying to, you know, what the latest, where the coyote will meet them. There's also, there are new discounts that are being offered by these smugglers. There's a family pack. You know, if you bring your family along, it will charge you $6,000 for the entire family, maybe $5,000. But if you want the VIP special, we will get you to Texas. We'll offer you three attempts at $5,500 or $7,500, depending on the size of the family. There are all these deals. I mean, it's a feeding frenzy. People feel like this is the moment. They have to do it now because the word is out there. Because I think the coyotes are also taking advantage of this sense of vulnerability on the part of these immigrants who obviously are not doing the right research, who should know that, you know, it's most likely they will be deported. But nonetheless, they feel that, look, if eight of them are deported or nine of them are deported or nine of them had a terrible journey, I will be the exception. I will somehow get across.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the politics of responding to the surge in illegal border crossings, and we're talking about the roots of the crisis. My guests are Alfredo Corchado of the Dallas Morning News, who's been reporting on this from Honduras. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Fernando Espuelas of the Univision America Network, who's been reporting on this from the U.S. side. Fernando, President Obama has asked Congress to approve $3.7 billion to help with this, especially the whole situation with unaccompanied children. And he had remarks after his meeting with the governor, with Governor Perry yesterday, and this is some of what he said.
What I emphasized to the governor was the problem here is not a major disagreement around the actions that could be helpful in dealing with the problem. The challenge is Congress prepared to act to put the resources in place to get this done? Another way of putting it, and I said this directly to the governor, is, are folks more interested in politics or are they more interested in solving the problem?
Is there a difference of opinion about exactly what should happen now? Is there a partisan difference on exactly what you should do?
The Republicans have a fundamental problem, which is a political problem, which is that they have blocked immigration reform for years and years and years. And most recently, it's been a year since the Senate passed immigration reform in a bipartisan basis. So beyond whatever their true beliefs are, this is primarily a political issue meant to, and this is something I asked a few members of Congress, are the Republicans, is it fair to say Republicans are using this particular matter to motivate their perhaps most anti-immigrant voters for November?
But Democrats have also been criticizing the president, saying, like, for example, Representative Henry Cuellar of Texas has said that the administration is one step behind on the border crossings. What do they want? Like, within his caucus, what do they want him to do that he is not now doing?
Right. So members of Congress are under tremendous pressure from Hispanic activists who are saying that the president is being way too harsh on these children and asking for expedited authority. This bill would also give them some sort of expedited authority to move these kids through the process in a much faster way.
Alfredo Corchado, some of the money would go to Central America, and I understand your primary focus is talking to the people and understanding, you know, what they're thinking and what they're hearing. But what is the posture, say, of the governments of, like, Honduras, of Guatemala? What's their stance toward this? Are they trying to stop it, or do they feel that that's not their responsibility?
So. Well, they mostly blame the United States. I mean, they say, look, the immigration talking to the United States, it's confusing, and it's leading to misinformation for people in Honduras. At this shelter, I mean, it was interesting. You get there and you're talking to people, and you know, there's promises that once these people come back from in buses from Mexico, there's anticipation that maybe they'll offer them a job or help them find a job. But you know, many of the people I've interviewed said, "Look, all I got was a piece of bread and a sandwich and a bus ticket back to my hometown." There's not much there for them. And when I talked to them, look, there's apparently money coming in for Central America. How would you like that money to be distributed? And they say, look, it's a temporary fix. If you don't get to the root of the problem, which is really creating jobs, education opportunities, training opportunities, you're not going to really solve anything. I mean, just helping train police, militarizing the area, which is really what we're seeing here. I mean, it's a lot of similarities to Mexico. That's not going to take care of the problem. You have to get to the root of the problem and create opportunities and try to get people out of poverty and try to get people out of harm's way. The impunity rate here, Michelle, is just incredible. I mean, more than 95% of the people who commit crimes are never really prosecuted. So you kill once, you kill twice. The situation is very similar to Mexico in that respect.
Fernando, final question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a number of times that some members of Congress are feeling pressure from their Latino constituents. Mm-hmm. What kind of pressure? What are people saying?
Well, I think that there are lots of mixed issues in this. The failure of immigration reform this year has been very disappointing. I think Politico had a poll out about 6 weeks ago that said that 90% of American Latinos favor immigration reform. So you can imagine what this represents.
There are also demonstrations saying, telling people, you know, get out and, you know, get out of the country.
That's energizing a lot of Hispanics. I mean, there are a lot of people who have called me on my show say that they're outraged by people protesting and being aggressive against children. I mean, that's why I think that's a really loser issue, ultimately, politically and from an optics standpoint for Republicans.
Fernando Espuelas is host of the Fernando Espuelas Show on the Univision America Network. He was nice enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Alfredo Corchado is a reporter with the Dallas Morning News. We reached him in San Pedro Sula in Honduras when he's been reporting on that aspect of the story. Gentlemen, thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan and members of his administration insist they are doing everything possible to find more than 250 schoolgirls who were kidnapped by Islamic extremists this spring. But after nearly 3 months, most of the girls are still missing. We get the latest from Nigeria. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The new film Boyhood shows a six-year-old boy and his older sister actually grow up. It's not a documentary, but a fiction film shot over the period of 12 years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Linklater, who wrote and directed the film. His other movies include Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Before Sunrise, and Bernie. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
There are lots of reasons to visit the French Riviera.
I mean, if you're sick, you're going to go there. If you have money, you're going to go there because the weather is amazing. I mean, even people from northern France, that's where they go during the winter time.
There are deep historical roots to French provincialism.
People still are very often attached to their native province as though to a different country.
And get tips for great day trips from Paris on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to bring you up to date on another important story we've been following. It's been nearly 3 months since more than 250 schoolgirls were kidnapped in Chibok, northern Nigeria. There was some relief in the country this week at the news that another 63 women and girls who'd been abducted by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram managed to escape their captors. Meanwhile, President Goodluck Jonathan, who has been heavily criticized inside the country and out for what is seen as an inept and ineffective response to the crisis, recently responded to critics in an op-ed in the Washington Post, saying, quote, "I am deeply concerned that my silence as we work to accomplish the task at hand is being misused by partisan critics to suggest inaction or even weakness." We wanted to know more about events around this story and also how this has been received. So we've called BBC correspondent Tomi Oladipo, who joins us from Lagos and has been helping us stay on top of the story. Tomi, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Hello, Michelle. It's great to be back on the program.
So what do we know about the 63 women who are believed to have escaped? Do we know any details of how they got away?
The story is still sketchy. We don't know exactly if it was all 63 of the women who were able to escape, and also we don't know what happened to them after the escape. There are some reports that say that the women were recaptured, so we don't exactly have any solid details on this. It's important to stress that this part of the country is remote and it's very difficult to get information regularly, even worse now that the security situation is at its worst.
Now, you recently spoke to a member of Boko Haram who claimed to be a teacher or some sort of a scholar within the group. Can you just talk a little bit more about the conversation that you had with him?
Yes, I met this man who said he was one of the members of this group, Boko Haram, and he talked about their ideology. And one of his main concerns, or he says the concerns of the group, is that a lot of Nigeria's Muslims are not living as true Muslims. He says that the democratic system of government is not the way to go. He says that Islamic law ultimately is what Nigeria needs. And he says that even non-Muslims will be able to benefit under this kind of rule. So that's what he says this group is pushing for. I asked him about the attacks that this group carries out. He said that this group only goes for its enemies. It only goes for people who speak out against it or people who fight against it. And he says that to justify killing innocent women and children in these attacks, he says these are just people who happen to be around areas where their enemies are. So when they actually carry out these attacks, he says they're not targeting the innocent people, that they are actually targeting their own enemies.
Were you able to ask him about this mass kidnapping and what was his justification for this? And also, it's important to note that they've killed, when they've attacked boys' schools, they've killed these boys in a very gruesome sort of manner. Were you able to discuss any of this with him? Did he have any answers about this?
I asked him about the kidnap of the girls, and he said this was in response to the Nigerian military's campaign to suppress the group. The Nigerian military has been going after this group and arresting its members, and they're believed to be thousands of them in custody. And he says this is why the group kidnapped these girls, saying that until their members are released, then the girls will continue to be kept. Of course, the government has expressed its concern, saying these men that it's arrested are dangerous, and that's why it's put them in custody. And regarding the rest of the attacks that this group has carried out, he said to me that this group wants to enforce this strict Islamic law, especially starting in northern Nigeria before it spreads to the rest of the country. And he seemed adamant that they would do that even if it meant being violent.
As I mentioned, that many people would like to hear from the president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post where he explained how important he says it is to him that the girls are found. What has been the reaction to this?
A lot of Nigerians have not been happy with President Goodluck Jonathan and his response to the kidnapping of these girls. A lot of Nigerians are not happy with the way he's handled the whole situation, feeling that he seems a bit detached from the whole situation, considering after the girls were kidnapped and this was in the news, the next day he was pictured, dancing at a rally and, several other events, public events subsequently after that. In fact, the vice president's brother died and the cabinet meeting was cancelled in his honor. And all that time, there was nothing about the missing girls. So a lot of Nigerians are still angry about the way the president has behaved in this manner. And they don't see his articles like this in the Washington Post as solving anything, really. So it's not really been taken in any good light.
It's interesting that it's also been reported, and I believe the president has confirmed that they've hired an American public relations firm to advise them. And the term of the contract. It was reported to have been a contract in excess of $1 million. Is that? I mean, many governments do this. I mean, but I wonder whether that particular detail has added some fuel to this as well.
It's believed that even this op-ed that President Jonathan wrote in the Washington Post would be a result of the PR firm, the advice from the PR firm. So even now, when you go to some of the government press conferences, you do see some of these PR people hanging around. The firm is clearly just trying to do its job, but in this scenario, you're pretty much trying to plug a burst pipe several hours after it's been broken. So there's a lot of damage already done, at least in damaging the image of the government, the image of the president in front of Nigerians. And so it's going to be very tricky for this company. Obviously, they'll just be doing their job and getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of repairing the image in the eyes of the Nigerian public, I'm not certain this will work.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tommy Oladipo. He's a correspondent for the BBC. He's bringing us up to date on issues surrounding the disappearance of those more than 200 girls from northern Nigeria earlier this spring by the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. You know, on the substance of the efforts to save, to rescue these girls, it's been reported that at a National Council of State meeting this week, former Nigerian leaders were given assurances that the girls are close to being rescued. And we've heard this a number of times in the past. Can you just tell us anything more about what efforts are being made, whether there are any negotiations? I mean, the government has said that they will not negotiate. You mentioned earlier that that Boko Haram has indicated that it would be interested in a trade for imprisoned members. Do you have any details about any efforts that are, in fact, being made?
There have been several efforts. Even the government did set up a committee that would look into working at a deal with this group. So as much as they sometimes say that they're not going to negotiate, there are some efforts going on behind the scenes. It's also known that some of the former presidents are also working together to put something, to work something out with this group. Obviously, the global concern that this incident has sparked is also putting increased pressure on the government and all the parties that are connected to this. So yes, it appears as if there is some kinds of negotiation. We don't know what the details are, to be honest, but yes, I would say that there is a lot going on behind the scenes.
Tommy Oladipo is a correspondent for the BBC. He was kind enough to join us from their studios in Lagos, Nigeria. Tommy, thanks so much for speaking with us once again.
You're welcome.
You might remember that Twitter and other forms of social media have been a hotbed for a discussion about Nigeria's missing girls. Now we move to a different conversation that's taken over social media for the past few weeks. We're talking about World Cup. Argentina beat the Netherlands yesterday to advance to the final. Well, they will face Germany. The Germans dismantled Brazil 7-1 on Tuesday, which sparked a social media firestorm. Twitter says the match was the site's most discussed sporting event ever. 35.6 million tweets went out during the game, and I may have had one or two of those. We wanted to get the latest on social media and the tournament, so we've asked ESPN senior writer Pablo Torre to speak with us. He was at yesterday's game, and he's with us now from Brazil. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Of course, Michelle. How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, better now that I'm speaking to you. So what are people talking about now that we're a few days away from the finals?
Well, it's really funny because I'm at these games. I'm physically sitting by these fields, and I'm still on Twitter monitoring everything. This is kind of where the conversation is happening. This is where you sort of get a sense of what the public is interested in, and it tends to be the case. I mean, we can rewind a little bit before we look ahead to Argentina, Netherlands versus Brazil-Germany. Brazil-Germany was this firestorm, was this sort of meme factory, because it was this most unexpected, most insane game, arguably in sports history. And so the conversation reflected that. Yesterday, it was kind of a lot of memes about people falling asleep. I mean, that was the relative tenor of that game. It was way more boring. Now, looking ahead, I mean, Germany-Argentina, I think the conversation is suffering a little bit because Brazil is not there. But I do think you're going to have one of the great superstars of the game, the superstar of the game, of the sport, in Lionel Messi, who is going to be in that game playing against Germany, the presumptive favorite. So we're going to have some storylines to monitor going ahead.
Well, the Brazilians can't be happy about arch rivals Argentina in the finals. Has that been fodder for some discussion?
Funny, I was just watching TV here, Brazilian television, and there was a segment involving a psychologist and a very sad interview with a child in a mall, and it had to do with Brazil losing, but also Argentina. I mean, the international rivalry between those two countries, who both, you know, talking to people in Brazil from Argentina, there is a sort of mutual sense of exceptionalism. And I think Brazil, in South America specifically, with regards to soccer, football specifically, but Brazil, to have Argentina make it to the Maracanã in Rio de Janeiro, where they expected and really demanded their team to take them, Brazil's own team to take them, the fact that Argentina, their most hated international rival, is there, is going to, that is certainly one constant stream of anger flowing across the internet and flowing across real life as well in Brazil.
So who are some of the most active players on social media? And what have they been up to? I know a lot of people in the U.S. are used to following people like LeBron James, for example, maybe Chris Paul, like people who are active in like the players' associations and stuff like that. But so who are some of the most active players? And is it very individual? I mean, is it the kind of thing where it's just kind of that person's kind of personal? It's like a personal thing that they like to do? Or do the teams encourage this?
You know, it's an interesting dynamic because I was way more versed in the NBA and those characters you mentioned and how they approach what we've called and continue to call branding, right? Personal branding. And LeBron, it's funny because LeBron right now, we're monitoring Twitter, seeing that's where the news is breaking about where he's going to play these coming years. And in soccer, in world football at the elite levels, there's a very similar dynamic that runs parallel. And I think of a couple of examples. Number one was Neymar, who is a superstar Brazilian player who got injured. Playing against Colombia, had a vertebra fractured by a Colombian player on a tackle. Instead of holding a news conference, instead of talking to reporters, Neymar released on social media a video addressing fans. He's much like a LeBron James is theorized to be doing, bypassing everybody to connect directly to fans and monetizing his own influence, his own popularity. And on the other end of the spectrum is a player, Luis Suarez, Uruguay's star player, who was, if you missed this incident, was basically caught biting the shoulder of an Italian player, one of many times he's done this in his career, and he had to apologize, and he did so. Well, first he refuted the fact that it was an actual bite on social media, and then he, of course, admitted to it once he realized, presumably, that everybody had seen teeth hit flesh. So you have these players dealing with the most contentious and most intriguing and most compelling storylines directly on social media, as opposed to going through guys like me at this point.
You know, it's interesting, though, that people are saying that it's kind of a two-way street. That, for example, we mentioned that the Brazil-Germany game broke Twitter records. The most watched World Cup semifinal game in U.S. history, which is interesting because even though the U.S. wasn't in it, and people say, well, the U.S. is only interested in matches that the U.S. is in, and that proved not to be the case. But some people think it's in part because of Twitter. What do you think about that?
Well, the reason why I think there is some validity there, and I think we should always caution ourselves in understanding that Twitter still represents a small percentage of the overall human population. Mm-hmm. However, when you talk about a promotional tool, I mean, Twitter is really, really intertwined with live sporting events. And I'm acutely familiar with this, and that's why I'm monitoring. That's why every journalist really is monitoring Twitter while they're monitoring the game, because you're getting news, you're getting information, you're getting jokes. And really, Twitter feels like a sports bar. It's a global sports bar, for better and for worse.
Yeah.
And that's why everybody ends up winding up there, even if they know it's probably best to sometimes take a step away from the screen.
So what were some of the funniest memes?
Well, I think for Brazil, I mean, you had these actually fairly impressive artistic renderings of someone reimagined the Brazilian flag with a goal that was full of seven soccer balls. I mean, you have these memes. I mean, there were blogs that were promoted immediately, sadbrazilians.tumblr.com, which was just a blog of everybody who was crying during these games. It was really, I mean, the televised experience is obviously the central focus, as it should be, but in terms of supplements, the internet gets to sort of hone in on all these little jokes that you probably end up talking about even more with the people next to you, people you've never even seen before, because there is this opportunity for, you know, what we call in a cliched way viral content ends up actually just being sort of funny and interesting and stuff that you may have missed the first time around.
So I'm not going to ask you to predict the winner of the final between Germany and Argentina, unless you want to. But I do want to know who's got the better social media game.
Oh man, I think, you know, until further notice, I think we follow sort of the alpha dog strategy here. Much like LeBron James at the top of his food chain, Lionel Messi is at the top of soccer. However, Germany, they have some very active players. Lucas Podolski, his username is lucas-podolski.com. I mean, you have guys who are really embracing the kind of social media world.
Okay.
And as for the prediction, I cannot say anything good about Argentina until I leave the borders of this country, so I will
okay.
abstain from that.
Okay, all right. Well, we're going to follow you because you've got mad game.
Oh, yeah, and follow
that's
me, right.
That's right, exactly. Paulo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN, one of our regular barbershop contributors with us from Brazil's capital, Brasilia. Paulo, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Up next, when two reporters for the Philadelphia Daily News wrote about corruption in the city's police force, as you might imagine, many officers were not exactly pleased.
There was a website in Philadelphia, and police officers would post things about what they wanted to happen to us, which is they hoped we got beaten, raped. They nicknamed us the Slime Sisters.
But the reporters pressed on, and now they've written a book about it all. It's called Busted, and we hear more about it ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is an appreciation of public radio and its commitment to introducing music to all walks of life. From the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world, whose stories take us there every day. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
You remember the doping scandal that took down Alex Rodriguez? It got its start in the Caribbean, with a dodgy medical college in Belize, and with young athletes who see baseball as their ticket out of poverty.
It's a hugely life-changing sum of money that's on the table if they manage to stand out from the crowd.
The quest to end steroids in sports on the world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Next Monday, Jeremy Hobson, co-host of NPR's Here and Now, will broadcast the national program live from the WILL studios in Urbana. We're excited to have him here, and we have lots of surprises planned. So make sure and tune in Monday, July 14th for Here and Now, starting at noon here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we're bringing you an encore of a conversation about a true crime story where it's hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. In 2009, two reporters at the Philadelphia Daily News turned a tip from a frightened police informant into a 10-month series that exposed corruption in the city's police department. They learned about officers routinely making up evidence, robbing innocent store owners, and sexually assaulting women. The reporting eventually led to a Pulitzer Prize, an FBI probe, and a book that tells the story behind the story. That book is titled Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. Now, actress Sarah Jessica Parker is reportedly on board to star in a television series based on the book. Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker are the authors. I caught up with them when they were in Washington, D.C. for a book signing. And before we begin, I should mention that this conversation contains details and language that some might find disturbing. That said, I started by asking Wendy Ruderman about Benny Martinez, the police informant who got the story started.
Benny Martinez had been a drug informant for 7 years, which is an incredibly long time. And what was happening was he was working with this one officer, Jeff Chudik, and Jeff Chudik had some real estate. So Jeff was renting him a house. In Philadelphia, being a drug informant is actually a job. You get paid for every door knock you do in which drugs are exchanged. You get $100 if a gun is found. So the money that he was making was flowing back to the police officer in the way of rent.
Why did Benny come to you?
Benny was looking for some protection. He was fearful of his life. He was afraid that either the police officer wanted him dead or the drug dealers on the streets wanted him dead, because what had happened was he and Jeff Chudik set up a big-time drug dealer who had enough resources to hire a very high-powered attorney, who that attorney then hired a private investigator and suspected that Benny had set him up. So basically had Benny followed around by the private investigator, who took pictures of Benny coming out of Jeff's house and establishing that they had this relationship that crossed the line.
Well, first of all, what did you think was wrong? And then secondly, what turned out to be even more wrong than that?
Right. Well, they had a financial arrangement. So that went against police department protocols. You can't have a financial relationship with your police informant. And so they also had a built-in financial incentive, the rent, to make drug buys. But the problem was that they were running out of people to set up. So basically, Benny, who had a drug habit, was going to places and not doing the buys because he didn't want people to know that he was the informant. So they were sort of making things up.
But it went far beyond that. So, Barbara, yes. Maybe you want to pick it up there. When did you realize it was actually bigger than that?
It went way beyond that when, after we started running the first stories about the relationship between Benny and Jeff Chudik, Wendy got a call from an attorney who represented a merchant in Philadelphia, a Jordanian man. And he said, you know the squad you're writing about? Well, they came into my store and they raided the store for these little Ziploc baggies that some of the corner stores sell. And in turn, they came in and they busted the video surveillance cameras, ripped wires out, and looted the store. And we remembered that from going through all these search warrants that we had for the first part of our story, we remembered that a lot of these merchants all across the city, all four corners of the city, had been raided by this same squad, where other squads did not raid these corner stores, mom and pop stores. So we went back to this room that has all the search warrants, and we went through hundreds and upon hundreds of warrants and picked out the ones where this squad raided bodegas, is what we call them in Philadelphia, these corner stores. And we tracked down these merchants across the city. And independently, across the board, they all told us the same story.
Which was what? Because some people might say, okay, well, so maybe it's against the law to be selling these little Ziploc baggies, because those can be considered drug paraphernalia.
Yes.
So, Barbara, what was so terrible?
What was so terrible is these cops came in. A lot of these merchants didn't even know they were cops. They were in plain clothes with just police on the back. And they dismantled the video surveillance cameras or cut out the wires, so there would be no record of what they did in the store. And what these merchants told us they did is, after these people were arrested, they looted the store. A lot of these merchants were hardworking immigrants who dealt mostly in cash. They paid for all the merchandise in cash, the rent, everything they had was in cash in the store. And they all told us that the cops not only took cash, but took batteries, cell phones, anything they could get their hands on, lottery money, and then left the stores in shambles and arrested these immigrants who had these stores.
And lied about how much money, because they actually had to invoice They had to invoice things that they took in for evidence, but what the store owners also told you is that they lied. They said they took 1,000 when in fact they took 7.
Right. The police have to fill out a property receipt. When they raid a house or a store, they have to itemize what they took, and they're able to legally confiscate things if they do arrest someone for drugs or whatever. None of these stores that we used had drugs in the store. They just had these little baggies.
And did these people have arrest records? Were these people who were known bad citizens, as it were?
None of them did. Not one single person who we used, and they all went on the record with us, and none of them had criminal records.
Yeah, and I think what
That's Wendy.
This is Wendy, yeah. What was so extraordinary about it is this had been happening to them for quite a while, and I think each store owner felt alone in this. Like, they sort of they didn't tell anybody about it. I mean, they came from countries in which the police are corrupt, which, you know, people disappear, those kind of countries. And so they felt like this was maybe part of the street tax. Like, we're just going to just be quiet about this. And they didn't realize that it was happening all over the city. I mean, we had people from, like Barbara said, the Jordanian man, and then Korean, Dominican, Chinese, Vietnamese, all different people told us the exact same story.
And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker. They won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 2010 with the Philadelphia Daily News in a series of articles that exposed police corruption in the city. They're telling their story in a more complete way in a new book titled Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. Now, I want to mention that what was going on in Philadelphia at the time when the series began, about half a dozen police officers had been killed that year in the line of duty, that people were not impressed with this reporting, if that's fair to say. You got a lot of criticism for it, Wendy, if you want to tell that part.
Yeah, we began this series at a time when an inordinate number of police officers were being killed, and it was horrible, and the mood in Philadelphia was very pro-police, understandably so. They have a very dangerous job. So our first series was basically cops skirting the law to set up drug dealers. So Barbara and I even wrote a story that let out a big-time drug dealer. He was looking at federal charges, and he was a drug dealer. But because they cut corners and lied on the search warrant, the feds had to let him go.
Well, it wasn't just that people just criticized you. Let's just be a little bit more clear about it, shall we? I mean, that a police blog listed your home addresses. People expressed the hope that you would be raped.
Right.
And that you would call 911 and that no one would come and things of that sort. Did that ever, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, there's a website. It's now defunct, but there was a website in Philadelphia, and police officers would post things about what they wanted to happen to us, which is they hoped we got beaten, raped. They nicknamed us the Slime Sisters, which, you know, we to this day like kind of joke with each other about. But it was serious at the time. The Fraternal Order of Police, which is a very powerful union in the city of Philadelphia, held a big press conference right after we ran the first stories to debunk our stories and say, really, we were like the lowest of low. You know, one step beneath a drug informant is a Daily News reporter, is the way they termed it.
Tell me about the sexual assault aspect of the story.
Right. Well, we had been hearing all along that there was one officer who his nickname was the Boob Man. And even police officers outside of Philadelphia who were in narcotics and worked closely with the Philadelphia police knew he had a fetish for large-breasted women. And during raids, he would take them into separate rooms, like back rooms, and he would pull up their shirt and fondle them. And in one really terrible case, he shoved his fist up a woman's vagina, and she was just so traumatized by it that she went to the hospital that very night. And they did a rape kit, and Internal Affairs had known who this cop was, and they took him off the street. But the thing is, then she disappeared because she began to get threats from the cops. And so,
how do you know she got threats from the police? How do you know that's who was threatening her?
Well, right. That's a good question. Go ahead, Barbara.
There was she lived in a neighborhood in Philadelphia, and at one point there was a police car that drove up and saw her walking along the street. They had her get in the car, and they threatened that she better drop it or she'd be sorry.
So let's fast forward here. The city has paid out in damages, has it not? I mean,
yes.
There have been lawsuits, and who has that money gone to? It's something like $2 million to settle lawsuits. Who has received that money?
It's gone to some of the merchants and two of the three women who sued the city, and the city has settled without saying they're guilty of anything, but they have settled. But I think that one of the most other outrageous parts of the story is that one of the merchants who actually had a backup video in his store that he provided us, he has lost his store. He's had to sell his house. And so he has lost his faith in America and the American dream.
Well, why? Why has he lost his store? Because
he was charged with this misdemeanor for having the little baggies, and then he owed money to lawyers because of the criminal case that he was charged with. And so he's lost a lot of money, so he could no longer afford to keep the store. And the women, too, they feel like nobody has heard them. For them to not even be questioned by a grand jury or be interviewed, I think is, I mean, it eats at us every day that that hasn't happened.
It's a hard question to answer, but why do you think that hasn't happened? Does either of you have a theory about that? Wendy, you started to offer some thoughts about that.
You know, it's very frustrating. We've heard that the FBI doesn't do sex crime, so they're waiting for the district attorney's office to do something about this officer and the women, and that the DA's office says, well, we're waiting for the FBI to finish its investigation. But I also think that Philadelphia is one of its problems is it's a big union town. The union has a all the unions really have a stranglehold on the city, and it just seems like in Philadelphia, the Fraternal Order of Police, they're like kingmakers. They can make a mayor. They can break a judge. They basically control a lot of the political powers that be, and people are terrified of the Fraternal Order of Police.
What do you want people to draw from this?
Even when we were writing the part of the story where they were cutting corners to lock up drug dealers, we still believed that that was wrong and that that should have a light shined on it because it's a slippery slope. If it's maybe the drug dealer one day, maybe it's someone like me or you the next day. So we don't feel like police officers should be able to break the law, to enforce the law. Yes, we got backlash, but letting people know that this was going on was important to us.
Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker are investigative reporters with the Philadelphia Daily News. Their work earned them the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. They recall that entire experience in a new book titled Busted, A Tale of Corruption and Betrayal in the City of Brotherly Love. And they were kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Wendy Ruderman, Barbara Laker, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Since this conversation originally aired, Philadelphia has fired Jeff Chudik. He is the officer at the center of the scandal and disciplined three others. And finally today, as this program winds down, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st, we thought it would be nice to hear some of the music that members of our staff like to listen to as part of our series, In Your Ear. Alicia Montgomery is our editorial guru on the program. Let's hear what's on her playlist.
Hi, I'm Alicia Montgomery, the supervising editor of Tell Me More, and here's what's playing in my ear.
I got moxie. I'm so damn foxy. Industry try to block me like cops and paparazzi.
I've been working on the show for 7 years, almost since the very first days of it, and the song that really reminds me of the spirit of Tell Me More is the Fugees, Take It Easy.
I see you looking, but you better take it easy. They tell your goons that they better take it easy. Here comes the rocket launcher, take it easy. Take it easy, you better take it easy.
What I really like about this song is there's like energy in every beat. And there's not sort of a moment to rest. And there's the type of music that's all about harmony and finding the sweetness and the moments of gentle beauty. And this is exactly the opposite. I mean, it just runs right at, you know, the heat and the power and the energy. And I just love it.
You scared yet? Pack the dibby dibby dub box.
Lying all alone. I'm thinking, staring at the stars. I wonder, since I've been away, I'm lonely, when I'm gonna go back home.
Another song that's playing in my ear that I've just come to fall in love with is Go Back Home by Audra McDonald. We had the chance to interview her between her fifth and her sixth Tony and talk about her album.
I'm thinking when I'm gonna go back home. Oh, me, oh, my
sometimes you need a song that lifts your spirits, and other times you need a song that meets your spirit wherever it is. And if you're in that sort of moment of indecision or confusion, or you just have a longing to get back to a place of certainty, of comfort, I mean, this song so speaks to that in the most beautiful way.
Empty spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know this score. On and on, does anybody know what we are looking for?
Another song that's playing in my ear is The Show Must Go On by Queen. The thing that I love about it is anybody who's sort of in broadcast or in anything that requires a performance, you have that moment where, you know, maybe you've had a rough day or maybe your mind is somewhere else and maybe you feel like you could have used another 2 hours of sleep. But this song is like an anthem for those moments where, you know, Freddie Mercury's voice just grabs you and just lifts you up and says, yeah, you've got to get out there, you've got to get on the stage, and you've got to make it happen.
Show must go on. Show must go on. Yeah. Inside my heart is breaking. My makeup may be flaking, but my smile still stays on.
That was Tell Me More supervising editor Alicia Montgomery telling us what's playing in her ear. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.